This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Thursday, March 24th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker.
And this is yet another reminder that the world must unite. We must be together, regardless of nationality or race or faith, in fighting against the scourge of terrorism. We can and we will defeat those who threaten the safety and security of people all around the world.
That was President Obama on Tuesday speaking about the ISIS attacks that day in Brussels, in which 34 people were killed. Dexter Filkins is here to discuss ISIS in Europe and the propaganda war. Not long ago, the West didn't really worry so much about ISIS. It was seen as a movement focused on building a caliphate in the Middle East. Then, of course, came the attack in Paris 4 months ago and the bombings in Brussels this week. Have ISIS's goals changed, or did we just misread their intentions?
I don't think they've changed. I do think that they're getting hit pretty hard in Iraq and Syria. It's hard to notice, but they've lost a lot of territory, probably 20% of the territory they had in Syria, as much as 40% in Iraq. And I think it's easy for them to hit Europe because, you know, there are large Muslim communities there across the continent. And so they can tap that pretty easily. But I wouldn't go as far as to say this is a measure of their desperation. But I do think that it's connected. This was not an original goal of theirs. But I think it's in retaliation for as hard as they're being hit.
They've lost something like 10,000 men and need to, of course, continue bringing in new recruits.
That's the thing. I mean, the numbers are really extraordinary. ISIS, since they were born in the desert, you know, only 4 or 5 years ago, they've drawn about 38,000 foreigners to come and fight with them. I mean, think of that, 38,000 people. About 7,000 of those are Westerners, most of them from Europe.
Talk about that a little bit. ISIS really has an evil genius for propaganda, and obviously they use attacks like this to lure in more recruits.
They do. I think what this speaks to is, first, the isolation of some of the Muslim communities in Europe and how isolated an individual can become sitting on his computer in the internet. But I was just interviewing somebody yesterday, actually, and, you know, the estimates are that as many as 40% of the Europeans that have gone to Syria to fight are converts to Islam, which is kind of an interesting twist. I'd never heard that.
George Packer wrote recently in the magazine about Tunisia, which was, of course, the heart of the Arab Spring, and how vulnerable teenage Tunisians are to the message of jihad. Why aren't we winning the war of ideas with young people?
I mean, Tunisia is different than Europe, but I think these are frustrated young men sitting around without anything to do, and they look into their future and they don't see much, and then they see Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi in the desert saying, come and fight. Come and fight and be somebody. One thing that looms, I think, over all of this, ISIS's their predecessor in Iraq was al-Qaeda. They always shunned the idea of holding territory, and Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi said, I'm going to take territory. I'm going to hold it. I'm going to be a state. And so here's this place the size of Wyoming where people can actually go and they can actually visualize it. And there's a government and there's a state. And I think that's very, very attractive.
And where is al-Qaeda in all of this?
Well, they're kind of sitting on the sidelines. Sitting on the sidelines, certainly in Europe. In Syria, they've been relegated to this group called Jabhat al-Nusra. And they fight ISIS in Syria. They rarely get together, even though ostensibly they're both fighting to topple the regime of Bashar al-Assad. And then there's still remnants of al-Qaeda all across the Middle East and South Asia, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Yemen. But they've really been decimated over the years. I mean, their ranks have been very, very thinned. And I think as ISIS has gotten stronger and as they've cranked up this really extraordinary propaganda machine that they have, you're seeing al-Qaeda really being eclipsed. At least I think in the terms of perception, they're being eclipsed. In numbers, too, actually.
Help us understand a little bit about Belgium itself. Ben Taub wrote for the magazine not so long ago about the connection between Belgium's pre-ISIS jihadi networks and a radical group in London that provides ideological training for potential jihadis. It's kind of remarkable for all of the money and arms that have gone into exporting democracy into the Middle East. The West seems to be losing the propaganda wars. Isn't this a key part of intelligence work?
It is. I think everybody's struck by just how little the intelligence agencies knew or how little information they shared with each other. I mean, if you look at some of the statements of Belgian and French officials after these attacks, they all but said we knew this was coming and we couldn't figure it out. There was so much chatter on the wire about people talking, people moving, and they arrested hundreds of people and they still couldn't get them. And again, I think that that speaks to the neighborhoods in Belgium where these guys hatch their plot. I think they're really cut off, they're really isolated, and when the police come in there and start asking questions, nobody cooperates.
All right, we have to turn to the presidential race because the Brussels attacks obviously are now a big part of that. Ted Cruz blamed Obama, unsurprisingly, the weakness and appeasement, as he put it, of the Obama administration for fueling ISIS. And he also said that police here need to patrol Muslim neighborhoods before they become radicalized. Then Hillary Clinton had a rapid response.
So when Republican candidates like Ted Cruz call for treating American Muslims like criminals and for racially profiling predominantly Muslim neighborhoods, it's wrong, it's counterproductive, it's dangerous.
So what about the propaganda wars at home, Dexter? I mean, fear-mongering works. We've seen that with Donald Trump's campaign. That's what it's all been about.
It does work, but I think that there's a big difference between Europe and the United States. Europe has a real problem dealing with its Muslim communities. I mean, we've seen that. We haven't had historically the same problems in the United States. The Muslim community here, they're completely mainstream. They're not radicalized. They're not even isolated. And when you hear presidential candidates talk about some of the measures that they're proposing, it's a little scary because you think that this is exactly the thing that's going to radicalize communities and it's going to push people into the shadows.
Trump's talking about waterboarding terrorism suspects.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically a competition about, you know, who would bomb more and who would torture more. But I think what's notable about all these candidates is that not one of them is suggesting putting troops on the ground in Syria, combat troops. No one is suggesting fighting. So what can they talk about? They can talk about dropping more bombs or they can talk about torturing people. But there is no public support in the United States for going into a ground war in Syria and Iraq, which, you know, would conceivably at least could eliminate the problem. But nobody wants to do that. So in a way, there's actually quite a consensus across the board. I think the only candidate who suggested putting troops on the ground was Lindsey Graham. And, you know, I think he polled like at 1%.
Yeah, and he's now back Ted Cruz.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
So what about actual intelligence gathering at home? The CIA used to rely heavily on human intelligence abroad, and the FBI had its own role here. They were really hampered by their unwillingness to work together. Now we have this vast counterterrorism structure. How well does it seem to be coordinating information?
We should start off by just talking about Europe's coordination.
Yes.
I think that there's just an enormous frustration in Europe that you have all these different intelligence agencies, whether they're in France or Belgium or Germany, and they don't share their information. And they're supposed to share their information, and they don't. And you can say, wow, that's really remarkable. Why don't you just share your information? It's hard for intelligence agencies to do that. And we know that from our own experience in the months before 9/11. It's one of the great scenes in our colleague Larry Wright's book.
The Looming Tower.
The Looming Tower. The CIA knew that two really bad guys who had been at a meeting of terrorists in Malaysia had entered the United States. And two of these guys ultimately were, you know, involved in the 9/11 attacks. And they didn't tell the FBI that they were here. And the FBI was begging the CIA for more information, and they wouldn't share the information. So we've seen this problem before, and we've seen it at home. I think the intelligence sharing in the United States is much better. But I think that if you look at, there was a young man from Sebastian, Florida, named Munir Mohammed Abu Salah, who had recently graduated from high school. He flew to Syria. He joined the al-Nusra Front, which is the al-Qaeda franchise there. He trained with them. He came back to the United States. He played basketball with his friends, hung out for a while, went back to Syria, carried out a suicide bombing and killed 140 people. And no one in the American intelligence agencies knew that he was over there until they saw his martyrdom video. You know, that's how hard it is to track people. Although I want to jump back because in the papers this morning, the Turkish president Erdogan was quoted as saying that they had turned back one of the men who eventually became one of the bombers. He was trying to cross from Turkey into Syria, and they picked him up and they deported him. This is last year. They deported him back to the Netherlands and said, here's a bad guy. We think he's a terrorist. You should detain him. And nothing happened. So somebody clearly dropped the ball.
So what do you think going forward? First of all, just in Europe, what changes are likely to be made?
In the past, there have been suggestions and laws and even a sort of tiny agency to gather and share intelligence better. And so I think we're going to probably see a lot of that. The whole principle of the European Union is open borders internally. So if you're in Germany, you can go to France without a visa, and you can go to Italy without a visa. But I think these terrorist attacks are putting that whole regime, that whole idea in question. All these guys, most of the bombers, had traveled to Syria and back, and they essentially migrated. And once they got into Europe, they were able to move freely anywhere else in Europe. And so if you look at the Paris attacks, they were hatched in Paris, they were planned in Belgium, they came back, they went to Syria, they came back to France and to Belgium. They can just move freely anywhere they want. And I think that's one of the founding principles of the European idea and the European Union. But I think that increasingly that is seen as no longer tenable.
And is this under discussion in the EU?
Absolutely. No one wants to go there. The creation of a united Europe is one of the great accomplishments of the 20th century, you know, and we can see now that it's under threat not merely because of the financial crisis and all the problems that they're having, but also from the massive refugee crisis they're having and now the terrorism problem, which has kind of grown out of that.
What you're saying reminds me that actually John Cassidy wrote this in a blog, I believe, this week for The New Yorker. Last year, Belgium's prime minister said after a New Year's plot was uncovered in Brussels, he said, I believe that we are being confronted with a new stage in the history of Europe. Do you agree with that?
I think so. It's hard to imagine that they're not going to start to check visas at the border. I think the larger problem here is what to do in Syria, in Syria and Iraq. This is the source of the problem, really, ultimately, and it's a black hole in the Middle East. It's getting bigger. It's flooding Europe with refugees. Ultimately, the world is going to have to figure out a way to bring the terrible civil war in Syria to an end.
And no one has any idea how to do it.
No, except that the Russians decided that the best way to stabilize things was to keep Bashar al-Assad in power, who, you know, would be indicted for war crimes tomorrow if he landed in Europe.
What do you think about that choice?
I got into an argument last night with a former official in the Obama administration about this. But increasingly, it's hard to tell the difference between Putin's idea about Assad and the White House's idea, which I think is we hate Assad. He's a terrible human being. He's probably guilty of genocide. But to allow him to fall and to allow the Syrian state to collapse would be a prescription for even more and greater chaos and more terrorism than we have until now. So what do we do? So we're stuck with this kind of terrible human being that the Russians have decided to keep in power.
Well, and that'll be a question that'll come up during the general election campaign here. Let's say it's Trump versus Hillary, which seems likely at this point. Do they have different assessments of that?
I don't think anybody knows what to do here. So everybody can agree that ISIS is terrible and everybody agrees that Assad is evil. But then what? And nobody wants to send ground troops. And so this is why the world is stuck. You know, we're in year 5, 500,000 people dead, something like 9 million people homeless, either refugees or displaced internally. And nobody has any ideas about how to fix this. It's the great tragedy of our time. And everybody's just staring at it, wondering what they can do.
Thanks so much, Dexter. Dexter Filkins is a staff writer and the author of The Forever War. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. This podcast is produced by Alex Barron for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.
You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts in the iTunes store. You can find past episodes of The New Yorker Out Loud, The Political Scene, and The New Yorker's fiction and poetry podcasts at newyorker.com/podcast. The weekly audio edition of The New Yorker is available at audible.com.